Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. And I'm going to be introducing my guests in just a moment's time. We've had loads of feedback to the last couple of weeks of programmes. I was joined by two Bible scholars, Bart Ehrman and Richard Borkham, on two different sides of the issue of eyewitness testimony in the Gospels. And we'll be hearing some of what you had to say in what were two lively and very informative discussions. I'd also like to remind you, and if you're a regular listener, you'll know all about this, Unbelievable, the Conference 2016, coming on Saturday the 2nd of July at the Brewery in London. I'm going to be joined by a host of brilliant speakers and thinkers as we look at the issue of evangelism, how we can put a confident, coherent case for Christ towards our non-Christian friends and colleagues. And if you want to be there as well, do go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. It's going to be a really great day, and I look forward to meeting many show listeners there. Later on today, if you can continue listening to Faith Explored this afternoon, you'll hear me interviewing Baroness Caroline Cox. She spent a lifetime working in the halls of power on behalf of the persecuted church around the world and fighting slavery as well, modern day slavery. So look out for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. Right now, time to get into today's discussion and meet our guests.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, have atheists got the wrong God? In God is No Thing, Rupert Short argues that many atheists have misconceived God. He writes that Richard Dawkins et al. Literally don't know what they're talking about because the God in whom they disbelieve is an idol resembling a blown-up creature. Well, in the book, he makes the case for coherent Christianity, covering the rational case for God from philosophy, who Jesus was, the resurrection, the cultural wealth of Christianity, understanding scripture and experiencing faith, all within about 100 pages. It's not a terribly long book, but he does cover a great deal of ground. Well, Rupert joins me on the show today to talk about the book. He's the religion editor for the Times Literary Supplement, and he's written biographies for Rowan Williams, Pope Benedict, and a book called Christianophobia, a book on the global persecution of Christians. And joining us to discuss whether God and Christianity can be coherent concepts is Jeremy Riddell, dialogue officer for the British Humanist Association. As an atheist, he'll be interacting with Rupert today on whether he has made a coherent case for God. Gentlemen, welcome along to the programme today.
Hello.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both with me. Both new to the programme, I should say. So it's lovely to have some fresh voices on the show. Let's introduce you first of all, Rupert, as the author of this new book. You've written a few books in your time, but most of them along religious lines. That's partly, I guess, because of the role you hold at the Times Literary Supplement. But what sparked this particular book, God is No Thing?
3 years ago, I entered the Hazlitt Essay Prize with an essay in defence of Christianity, and my agent then suggested that I might turn it into make it the basis of a short, punchy reply to the new atheists, as they're known. And as you're aware, Christianity has been under, well, religion in general, but Christianity in particular, perhaps, has been under very sustained intellectual attack over the past decade or so. I don't think that any of the arguments are really new. They hail back to controversies that took place, for example, between the wars, and which many people might have thought had been kicked into the long grass. But they've nevertheless resurged, and they've been very popular. These screeds, polemical works, call them what you like, have sold in their millions, and I thought that it was it was reasonable to bite back a bit, as it were.
Not the first person to do so, in a sense, and I think it was getting on for 10 years ago now that the God delusion came out, which probably characterises a lot of the literature you're referring to. But you felt that, I mean, the title of the book, maybe let's talk about that. You feel that very often these books that are, you know, making the case against God have got the wrong God in mind, essentially.
Yes, Richard Dawkins is, of course, a distinguished zoologist. We had the same inspirational biology teacher at school, actually. He's sometimes cited, dear Mr. Thomas, who's now well into his 90s, as an inspirational force. And about a generation later, I sat in the same classroom with the same...
You mean you went to the same school?
I went to the same school. I don't think that Professor Dawkins has ever acknowledged publicly, at least not in my hearing, that dear old Mr. Thomas happens to be a devout Christian.
Right.
Ever since I was at school, really, or not long after, I have been very interested in the challenge of how one might articulate a Christian worldview that is philosophically and scientifically literate. And this is the result.
Right. Your own journey, were you raised in a Christian environment? Did you have any agnostic period or anything like that?
Yes and no, in terms of formation. My parents were nominal Christians, somewhat lapsed. We went to church once in a blue moon. Religion wasn't really discussed at home. On the other hand, I did attend Christian schools, and I was a chorister in an Anglican choir, although I'm a Roman Catholic myself. So I did absorb quite a lot by osmosis, and I decided that I would like to study theology at university, which I duly did, innocently imagining that this would help me to clarify my views on religion. And you won't be amazed to hear that I ended up a lot more confused at the end of the course than I had been at the beginning. And I would say that I had a good few years of agnosticism. I was sort of at odds with the establishment in two respects, really. One in having a Catholic background, and secondly, because I didn't really believe a robust version of the faith, and I didn't go to church for a while. That my worldview came to take on a Christian shape was a slow process involving quite a lot of reading and living and interacting with other people who showed me the way.
Obviously, partly an intellectual process, partly a spiritual process, if you can divorce the two.
Yes. This is a tricky one. Comparatively few people come to faith as a result of intellectual arguments. Many people are not interested in technical arguments about the existence of God, but they do ask questions about how to live. And in terms of religious practice, I would be among the first to say that it's not a question of the God hypothesis, as Richard Dawkins has called it. You don't inspect the faith, as it were, under laboratory conditions. You don't think your way into a new way of living. You live your way into a new way of thinking. You set out on the way, and religion is really about practice. It's about doing things that change you.
I like the way one friend of mine put it recently. He said, the gospel doesn't need defending, it needs living, which I thought was quite a nice way of putting it.
That's right, there's a line that's dear to me. You know, watch how you go. You may be the only gospel that other people ever read. But having said all that, I am bullish in the early sections of the book on philosophical and conceptual matters, which I think tend to be rather overlooked. Everywhere I go, whether I'm in a cab or in a cafe or in the pub, I meet world-renowned experts on religion who tell me what I as a Christian believe, which is invariably a total caricature, and then tell me that I'm an idiot for believing it. And amid all this comment about religion being a projection, religion being a nice, comforting fantasy, let's leave to one side the moment for a second the fact that most Christians, I think, would consider their faith to be at least as much of a challenge as a comfort. There's a conceptual slackness to my mind in all of this, because it is not possible, in the terms scientific naturalism allows, to say how anything could exist at all. The ultimate question of why there is something rather than nothing, I think, ought to bring us all up short.
Well, yeah, and Rupert Short is the man bringing us up short with the questions that are raised in this book, God is No Thing. It's a really good book, by the way. It reminded me a little bit of a sort of kind of an academic version almost of Francis Spufford's Unapologetic. I think you've appreciated his writing as well, haven't you, Rupert?
But that's a wonderful book, and I wouldn't claim to be in his class, but he's very generously supplied an endorsement.
And slightly less swear words as well. But in any case, great to have you also joining us today, Jeremy. Jeremy, you're the dialogue officer for the British Humanist Association. Briefly, what does the dialogue officer do for the BHA?
Well, what it means is we obviously don't like the term interfaith because we're not a faith, but it does mean talking with people who have different beliefs.
Well, you've come on the right show, then.
I hope I have.
Unbelievable. So, I'm first time our meeting, actually, Jeremy. So, do you want to give us a little background to your background as an atheist, as a humanist, and so on?
Yes. So my father was Jewish, but very non-religious, liberal Jewish. When my mother converted to liberal Judaism when she married him, she was lukewarm CV, I think it's fair to say. I went to, and I was sent to Sunday school and learned a little bit about Judaism in that. I must admit, I rather rebelled against that. I was at a school where our morning assembly was actually in the parish church, which was next door to the school. And I rather like that. I mean, it was a beautiful old 15th century church and stained glass windows, and the hymns were nice and, you know, culturally very, very attractive. But, of course, when I read the words, I thought, well, I don't believe a word of this.
Right.
So I went through the typical journey when you go to university and you meet a lot of people with diverse views. I was very interested in Buddhism for a while. I still think there's some very sophisticated ideas in Buddhism, which, in terms of time in particular and presence in the moment, which we could take on board. But by the time I left university, I was pretty clear. I was an atheist. I didn't believe in God. I thought I was fairly clear view about morality, about ethics. But it took 25 years before I realized that the views I had, there was a label for those views. And it was only because I had a humanist wedding because I didn't want a religious wedding. I had no idea what humanism was. Found these people on a website, and they, you know, the celebrant did a fantastic job. And I went back and thought, well, what are these people about? And I read about it and I thought,
I'm
that's
a humanist,
me.
It turns
out. I didn't know that. And that is not an uncommon experience.
Sure. Yes, and I understand the humanist weddings and naming ceremonies and so on becoming very popular these days. Have you sort of interacted with the kinds of arguments before that Rupert has brought over in the book?
You don't live in this country for decades without encountering these discussions and these arguments, of course.
Up to this point, obviously, you've never felt you've been given a compelling case or rationale for God.
No.
Have you ever sort of gone on any sort of search in that direction? Has you know, you obviously had a pleasant experience of church as a child, so
yeah.
It doesn't sound like you particularly had anything to rail against in that sense. But you, in the end, you've felt that Christianity doesn't have anything.
Yeah, I mean,
to
I think
you.
What I rail against is what I perceive as faith-based privilege and imposition of faith-based ideas on me or broader society. So some of that does make me, you know, it motivates me to act. And I think, I'm sure we're going to have a very civilised discussion here, and my belief is that, you know, Rupert and I probably have huge overlap and huge area of common ground in terms of we're both liberal thinkers. But that isn't characteristic of faith and Christianity globally in many, many examples. And so I'm very concerned right now, you know, there are countries in the world where you can be executed for being an atheist.
Right. Well,
and
that's
a very significant thing.
We'll talk about secularism and Christianity and the global situation a bit later on, I think, in the programme. But for the moment, thanks for joining us on the show. We're going to be asking the question initially, have atheists got the wrong God? And if you'd like to interact yourself with this question, perhaps send me an email with your thoughts on today's show. You can, of course, email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be happy to read out some of the emails next week on the programme, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the show later on in today's programme. You can also find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Perhaps you'd like to add your comments underneath the latest programme. Perhaps find us on social media at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to follow the show on Facebook. And do get in touch. It's always good to hear from you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're asking, have atheists got the wrong God? Rupert Short's book, God is No Thing, argues that many atheists have misconceived God, believing in a sort of an idol resembling a blown-up creature, he says. That's often what he encounters when he's interacted with the literature of the so-called new atheists. Let's talk about this a little bit, because what do you think fundamentally many atheists you read get wrong about God?
Well, I think you've summed things up very well, Justin. I mean, if God were like the celestial headmaster or great science professor up in the sky, represented by Richard Dawkins, then certainly I too would count myself an atheist. But of course, that isn't the God of classical Christianity. I think if we look, for example, at a figure like St. Thomas Aquinas, who really does encapsulate the classical Christian tradition, he wasn't really concerned with some enchanted world beyond science's powers of disenchantment. He was interested in pressing more and more deeply into a scientific account of the natural. For already in that world there were things which only his religion would be able to explain. And so, in other words, God isn't supernatural in the way that term is normally understood. If we were to call God supernatural, it wouldn't be because he's quote-unquote extra-natural, but because he's the author of nature itself, and so both inside and outside.
Do you get the sense that sometimes the way that God is characterised in the literature, it's as though you've got the universe, and then you've got this extra entity that is God,
who dwells outside it. Yeah, yes, exactly. So, I think the classical Christian doctrine of creation out of nothing really helps us along here. It's not that the world is made out of something, and because the world is made out of nothing, and that can't be accounted for in naturalistic terms, then everything at all times is radically dependent on God. It's rather a mind-bending notion. Everything has its own integrity in scientific terms, but in the same way that a canvas supports a painting or a minstrel supports a tune, God is the underlying force, presence, holding everything in being at any given time.
What Paul Tillich
described God and nature operate on different levels.
I think Paul Tillich used the phrase "the ground of all being." That's the sort of seems to be kind of what you're describing.
Yes, and because almost. God isn't a thing, God can be closer to me than I am to myself, as St. Augustine says. And I do want to just press back to this business about why there is something rather than nothing, because Richard Dawkins and his allies have tried to represent this as simply one more stage in a chain. Science has got us this far, and it's going to get us a little bit
further. So Lawrence Krauss, for instance, is the epitome of this in his book.
He's had the gall to write a book called
A Universe from Nothing.
I was having dinner last night with a scientist turned theologian who said to me, I think Professor Krauss is a great scientist, but not a great philosopher. When you look carefully at that book, I think he uses the term nothing in about four different ways. Each of them is productive. A quantum vacuum is not nothing. Mm-hmm. Space-time is not nothing. The laws of physics are not nothing. You need to go to a theologian, Dennis Turner, to have to get hold of a more philosophically rigorous definition of what nothing really is. Nothing, he writes, has no process, no antecedent conditions, no random fluctuations in a vacuum, no explanatory law of emergence, and there being nothing for quote-unquote something to be out of, there can be no physics, not yet.
Yes.
For there is nothing yet for physics to get an explanatory grip on. Now, that might all sound a little bit dry. I want to stress that philosophical reasoning of this kind, it takes you to the threshold of a faith, but it's very important to say that that faith is a gift, and it doesn't get you beyond the threshold. But I would like to steer a middle way, really, between a form of reasoning which is a little bit more associated with Catholicism, which I think does try to construct a kind of ladder, as it were, and an understanding more associated with Protestantism that places an emphasis on faith. And I find it helpful as a Christian interested in these arguments to resort to a sort of a three-stage process in particular. I would start to build my framework first from an awareness of ourselves as embodied beings with the capacity to grasp meaning and truth. Second, I would want to look at the process of seeing our status as entailing a gift, prompting awe, gratitude, and a heightened sense of ethical awareness. And third, an acknowledgement of that gift as grounded in a reality that freely bestows itself to us. And I would want to say to the atheist, I wouldn't for a moment question your right to hold the worldview that you hold. Atheism is a reasonable worldview, and if there's a heaven, I don't doubt that there will be many atheists, perhaps former atheists by that stage, with south-facing rooms. But in the meantime, while we're still stumbling about on Earth, I would want to say gently to the atheist, what does the cosmos have to be like for there to be moral truths which we can detect in the first place? And isn't the theist entitled to argue that belief in God provides a much more secure home for our impulses than the idea that moral truths somehow float around in a platonic limbo, or that they're just a matter of subjectivity? That there are there are serious arguments here that I think that the theists can lay on the table.
You've opened up a lot of ground there already. I'm sure you've come across a number of these issues before yourself, Jeremy.
Yes, I have.
But, I mean, shall we start with that, you know, going back to Thomas Aquinas, that whole thing of why is there something rather than nothing, and so on. Has this ever struck you as a difficulty as an atheist to explain the very fact of existence? Or do you just sort of, I don't know, take it as a sort of brute fact of our experience?
Well, it is a brute fact, because we're here having this conversation.
Indeed.
I think the answer to that question, though, is that nobody knows. And I think one of the things that, listening to Rupert's argument, it was going through my mind, is that actually this God, this very sophisticated conception of God, which Rupert is talking about, which I will come back to that in a minute, is actually becoming just a sort of label on the answer to the question to which we don't know the answer. And we do know a lot more than we used to know about how the universe we're in, which may be one of many universes for what we know, came into existence. Mm-hmm. A physicist is getting pretty close to that. There are aspects of that which are conceptually very difficult for somebody who doesn't have the mass to do it. You know,
do you think we'll get to a kind of... Do you believe we can get a physical explanation, though? Because I think the point Rupert's making is you're going into a different, completely different territory.
Yes.
When you know, you'll never get... If you're always looking for a physical reason... Mm. That will never get you to an explanation of why there is something rather than nothing in the end.
Well, of course, there's always a question about the first cause thing. So if there's God, then why is there God, and what was the cause of God? So you're just pushing the bump in the carpet backwards. We don't know the answer to all of that yet. It may be that, you know, the whole idea of a chain of causes, you know, that relies on time, on things, you know, words like before and after, but time itself is part of the creation process, and we I'm not sure as animals that have, you know, started in the savannas of East Africa and have done pretty well to actually understand as much as we do about the universe, you know, we are still making progress on that. For all I know, we may come to the point where we can't get our heads around it, you know.
Right.
But why should we better get our heads around it? Because we're not evolved to get our heads around it. So, but the fact that we can't doesn't mean therefore you can therefore say there was a deity is involved in that. It seems a non sequitur.
Well, I'll let Rupert respond to that in a moment. We've got to go to our first break. Time is flying by, and we're asking, have atheists got the wrong God? Rupert Short making the case for a coherent Christianity on the programme today. And also with us, Jeremy Riddell from the British Humanist Association. I'm Justin Bradley with Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking with interesting conversations between believers and non-believers every week. Do join me again after a short break.
If you've ever found yourself cornered by a skeptic who is intent on challenging your faith, and you've thought, how can I answer, or what do I say, let the Christian Thinkers Society help. Our mission is to teach Christians to become thinkers and thinkers to become Christians. We train believers to understand the core truths of their faith and how to demonstrate why Christianity makes sense. Find us at this year's Unbelievable, the conference. And for Jeremiah J. Johnson's new book, Unanswered, visit christianthinkers.com and find the answers you need.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, and on Unbelievable today we're asking, have atheists got the wrong God? I'll reintroduce my guest in a moment's time. Don't forget that if you want to get in touch with the programme, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll be reading some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme later on in the show. You can find us online as well, today's programme, and where you can comment there at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Unbelievable. You may be interested in finding out more about Unbelievable, the conference as well, 2nd of July. If you're interested in making the case for Christianity, making a coherent case for Christianity, well, we're going to have some top thinkers and speakers joining us for that conference in London on the 2nd of July. More details at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. Have atheists got the wrong God, we're asking today. Rupert Short, in his new book, argues that many atheists have misconceived God. God is no thing, he said, but he's not nothing either. And we've been hearing in the first section of today's programme about some of the philosophical arguments that Rupert brings to bear in the book for the rational case for God. On the other side of this conversation, Jeremy Riddell, dialogue officer for the British Humanist Association, has been responding, and we'll get to much more, I'm sure, in the course of the programme, gentlemen. But what he had to say to you there, Rupert, Jeremy, was, as far as he's concerned, these things are mysterious. Science is always progressing. We may not get to a complete understanding of how the universe came into being. But God is not an adequate explanation. It just sort of pushes the explanation back, because then you have that kind of question, well, what caused God, and so on. It's a bit of a non sequitur as far as being an explanation for why there is something rather than nothing.
Yes, Jeremy does raise an important challenge. But I think it's only an insuperable challenge if you think of God as a thing, as an agent whose agency displaces other things, another counter on the table, if you like. Christianity, and indeed other traditions in positing the existence of the Creator, is trying to point really to a different order of being. It's the idea that the universe does have an ultimate ground, namely the Creator, but while God's existence is inexplicable to us, it is explicable to God. I just really sum up my view by saying that reason infers the existence of causes from the existence of effects without always being able to infer the nature of the causes from the nature of the effects. And what applies in mundane spheres is all the more applicable, it seems to be, in a unique area of discourse such as creation. I remember one theologian of my acquaintance saying, Richard Dawkins knows what God is and knows that God doesn't exist. And this theologian said, I, for my part, feel sure that the entity named by Christian tradition as God does exist. But what God is in God's self is a subject on which I can say nothing at all. We're in the realm of mystery here. I think it's very important to acknowledge that advocates of religion need to display due humility here. Sometimes people have gone way beyond the natural perception of the mystery of existence. Somebody like Thomas Aquinas thought that too much religion was as bad a thing as too little, by which he meant, I think, that fundamentalism, what he would have called superstition, is a very bad thing. Mm. I'm saying in a nutshell that belief in God is a valid inference of metaphysical reasoning. You can't have something unless something else gives. I mean, that is science, as understood by ancient pioneers such as Aristotle and by science today. And I can't myself make sense philosophically or scientifically of an endless sequence of contingent causes. St. Thomas said it wasn't possible to establish by reason whether the world was created in time or whether it had always existed. As a Christian, of course, he trusted in the biblical revelation and held that the world was created in time, but he granted, in dialogue with pagan philosophers, that it could have existed forever, or at least that view was reasonable. But he also added that contingent totality, even if the world had existed forever, would still require the agency of the primordial being itself, that is God. And he distinguishes between two kinds of causal chain, which I find helpful. A father can give birth to a son, and that son can in turn father a son of his own. And each element in the sequence is discrete, it's separate. But he wants to draw our attention to what he calls an essential causal chain. Suppose you're holding a stick and you're pushing a stone. The stone moves because it's propelled by the stick. The stick moves because it's propelled by the hand. The hand moves because it's propelled by your arm, and so on, in a sequence that involves your nervous system, molecular structure, and ultimately the four fundamental forces in the universe. Well, maybe not ultimately, because behind that, on a Christian understanding, rests the uncreated agency of God, holding, sustaining everything in being at any given time. And I do want to stick with my principle that contingent reality is not its own explanation. As I've said before, that really should give us all pause.
OK, where are you going to go with this, Jeremy?
Well, I think there are a number of things that Rupert has said there, which obviously I don't agree with. Firstly, I think that the idea that there is this series of contingent steps, and that there's a first one of those, and when I would say, well, okay, what was before the first one? The answer is, the first one knows of its own creation, but that's mysterious to us. Well, to me, that's illogical. So I think we don't know the answer to this, and I don't think I don't know it, and I don't think Rupert knows it either.
But I mean, one thing: do you believe that there has to be a kind of first mover?
I don't know.
Rupert believes there must be, because you can't have an infinite regress.
But who says you can't?
Well, I guess logic and philosophy is what Rupert's drawing
on. A lot of people, other philosophers say you can. So, I mean, I don't know. I think we just have to be humble enough to say, you know, on that question, we may know everything about what the causes of the universe we're in, but then that pushes the question back into, you know, what lies behind that, and maybe we'll get some insight. I don't know, but this is stuff that we're investigating, and maybe or maybe not, we will find an answer to it. But to come up with, put a damp towel around your head and think, I'm Thomas Aquinas and I can find the answer to this by thinking about it, seems to me a rather arrogant approach. I mean, we don't know. Let's be humble. And so the overall impression I had reading Rufus' book is just reinforced, a humanistic view, which is that religion is a man-made creation. Mm-hmm. Maybe a few women in there, not very many actually, but it's a human creation, and a lot of this, the things we've just heard from, they are just made up. Now the thing about science, and I'm not going to say that science is the only thing in the world, because I'm a human being and my subjective experiences, you know, are not scientific, but the causes of them are. But at least the thing about science is, it doesn't make things up. It tries to find things out and is willing to change its mind when new evidence comes along. It's not sitting in a room with a damp towel around your head thinking about it. And I think that's a more respectable way of trying to understand the universe than speculation.
Rupert?
Well, as I've said, it's not that I would deny that atheism is a reasonable worldview, but I would stand by my belief that the theistic understanding is more reasonable. Even our virtue is not directly perceptible to us. It's part of our interpretation of the world that we perceive with our senses. I think we're both agreed that we are dealing here with a fathomless mystery, that the disagreement simply lies over whether there's an answer or not. And in the epigraph to the book, I quote a line from a theologian called Victor White, which I think sums things up nicely, when he says, St. Thomas's position differs from that of modern agnostics, because while modern agnosticism simply says, we do not know and the universe is a mysterious riddle, a Thomist says, we do not know what the answer is, but we do know that there is a mystery behind it all, which we do not know, and if there were not, there would not even be a riddle. This unknown we call God. If there were no God, there would be no universe to be mysterious and nobody to be mystified.
Jeremy?
I think that just makes my case for me, actually, because it's really saying that God is the label of the answer to the question. And if it feels better to use that term as a label, and then fine. But I think it's just a label on of something that we haven't yet defined and may never define. But when we use the term God, it carries with it a whole baggage of other things, which some of which Rupert's just referred to, which I can't see have anything to do with the fact that we don't know, understand why there is something rather than nothing. I mean, one of the things, for example, Rupert mentioned was moral truths and virtue.
Mm.
Now, as if these things have some sort of objective existence.
Mm.
And you know, that morality is something out there in the universe. You know,
to be discovered.
To be discovered. Now, it's interesting that one of the things that Rupert rightly emphasised about Christianity is the emphasis on love thy neighbour as a core moral precept. Of course, that isn't unique to Christianity at all. Of course, every ethical worldview there's ever been has the golden rule in it. And I'd certainly subscribe to that. It's not perfect in every case, but it's pretty damn good. And the reason we have that rule isn't because it's something out there, but it's come up in all these different circumstances with people who didn't believe in God or Christianity in the sense that Rupert's talking about, simply because we're social animals that need to live together in harmony, and we've evolved the ability to empathise with others, and that means we feel others' suffering. And we seek to alleviate
that. So you see morality as purely a kind of construct of our our evolutionary history.
It's emerged from us as
social beings.
Doesn't
exist anywhere other than, if you like, within that societal kind of complex that we've created.
That's right.
Yes. I have a feeling you don't agree with that, Rupert.
Yes, I mean, I already said earlier in the conversation that it's not that morality proves God. It's that our experience looked at in the round is hospitable to a theistic interpretation, let's put it like that. And I would add that although general reasoning can get you what you might call Aristotelian morality, the cardinal virtues, fortitude, justice, temperance, and what have you, does it really quite hit the spot? Does it get you to grace and forgiveness, which is... what I see as being at the heart of the Christian understanding. I'd also like to just move the conversation on a bit now, having cleared the ground a bit. It was helpful to hoof around the subjects we've done so far. But it is very important to emphasise as well that these arguments don't get you to a living faith. And I'm just conscious of the way that, a figure like Pascal... thought that God can be expected to appear openly to those who truly search for him, but to remain hidden from those who don't seek. There can't really be spectator evidence of God's existence, as though this most mysterious of quests could be resolved under laboratory conditions. You haven't asked me to try to define God yet, and of course that's an impossible task. But in the book, I do... quote a line from Rowan Williams, which I think is among the pithiest attempts at a definition that I've come across, combining spiritual and intellectual elements. And he said, in answer to a question from Melvin Bragg, God is first and foremost that depth around all things and beyond all things into which, when I pray, I try to sink. But God is also the activity that comes to me out of that depth, tells me I'm loved, that opens up a future for me, that offers transformations I can't imagine. Very much a mystery, but also very much a presence, very much a person. Now, the vision articulated there comes out of years and years of prayer and discipleship. It doesn't come out of of abstract reasoning. And I'll just add that the book is above all trying to say that the Christian understanding of the world is a coherent one. It's worthy of respect, not to be lightly dismissed. I'm actually not trying to convert anybody by writing this book. I move in a pretty secular world. I work on Fleet Street in a setting where few go to church. And it seems to me, you know, not at all that monotheism is logically coercive, but as I say, that it is a reasonable interpretation of the data of our experience in the round.
And part of that, going back to the original question that Jeremy had, being that you do conceive of there being this real moral realm of real moral virtues and duties and so on, which is not well founded in atheism, but does make sense on a sort of theistic worldview.
Yes, I do think that atheism has a little bit of a problem with what's known as a problem of with why there's something rather than nothing, and also with the question of normativity. It's the term used by philosophers to encapsulate the objectivity of morals. Now, two or three generations ago, it was reasonably common for philosophers to say, well, moral beliefs, they vary from society to society, they're pretty subjective. There is much more acknowledgement these days of the objectivity of morality, the conviction that torture is wrong and that compassion is good. They're not relative to different cultures. They are, one is right and the other is wrong.
And therefore you're saying they're not simply a construct of our social evolutionary history?
No, either. I mean, in the end, I believe that they are rooted in a transcendental object, namely God, and God being perfectly good in himself and the source of all created goodness supplies us with a means of navigation. And my goodness, I mean, I would be the first to say that that compass is available to non-Christians as well. There's a proof text in John's Gospel, John 14:6, which is sometimes seen as the proof text of Christian exclusivism. It's when Jesus is represented as saying, I am the way and the truth and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. My book, I should emphasise, Justin, is targeted at shallow, infantile, authoritarian versions of Christianity, as well as caricatures on the part of unbelievers. And I would want to come down like a ton of bricks on Christians who think that verse means that you will fry in hell unless you're a paid-up Christian. It doesn't mean that at all, because the me referred to is none other than the Word of God, which, as the prologue to John's Gospel makes clear, enlightens the hearts of all human beings. The Word of God, God's wisdom and reason, is in all of us because of the belief that we are all made in the image of God and therefore have that spark of divinity in us.
There's a whole lot of things that Rip's covered there. I think, could I go back to this question about morality? Because I think one thing I would certainly reject, and I think we would be in a full agreement here, is moral relativism. I'm not a moral relativist. I don't know anybody who's a humanist who is. But I think it comes down to some humility here, that we have a sense of universal human rights, for instance, which is an intensely application of morality. But we're still learning how to apply even this simple rule, the golden rule. So if we take the example of attitudes towards homosexuality, for instance, to me it's a no-brainer that if two people love each other and they want to get married, that they're going to be happy as a result of getting married. Therefore, it's an immoral act to prevent them from doing so, because you're reducing human well-being and you're increasing suffering. Now, it's taken us quite a long time in human history to realise that that's an application of the golden rule. For all I know, there may be other things to which we're today blind, which in the future will come. But the difficulty is that the way... And I Rupert's advocating a very sophisticated form of Christianity, but the way Christianity and most organised religions have worked in the past is they have sought to apply a set of rules and say, well, we understand what the meaning of that rule is. And if they take that particular example, the result has been, you know, prejudice and suffering.
I mean, I suppose for me, the question is, if you accept that equality is a good thing, mm-hmm. and it's good if society moves in the direction of equality for all people, I suppose my fundamental question is, and this may be your question as well, Rupert, I don't know, but wherein does that value come from? Why should we be looking for an equal society?
What is it that makes those truths true?
And I would say, again, it comes back to where the golden rule comes from, which is it comes from learning in every society, you know, of any background, that and also our innate sense of empathy, which we've evolved for some reason. We definitely have got it. Humans have it.
What if we hadn't evolved it? What if we had evolved into a society where, you know, it was generally seen as the best thing is to get what's yours and not share with
others?
Well,
then almost certainly if there have been societies like that, they've not succeeded.
Well, some societies do exist around the world which don't don't really operate via the golden rule.
That's true.
It does happen.
Yes,
and they still exist.
Yes.
So the question is why
not overall been successful? So and even those societies will apply some restricted form of the golden rule. They might say, well, we apply it to our lot, but not the other lot. You know.
Right.
So, which obviously we could easily argue our way out of. So I think you can very easily see how that these rules aren't given to us from the outside. They're things that we have evolved, and we are these, you know, conscious beings on this incredibly insignificant planet on an arm of a galaxy with a super massive black hole in the middle of it.
If someone isn't applying the golden rule,
yes.
What's the reason they should? Why would you tell them they should be? Is it because you're messing up the progress of our species because, you know... But they might turn around and say, well, I've got absolutely no interest in... You know,
no, but I think there obviously are people that are that, and we call them criminals usually, unless that they're doing it in a way like the prejudice against homosexuality, where in fact the society in general sanctions that non-golden rule behaviour, immoral behaviour, which has been the case until quite recently in that particular example. But what we tend to do is say society has decided that there are certain ways you've got to do it, and we have a set of laws which are always, we're seeking to improve every day, and if you do go around murdering people, you will be prevented from doing that by the law. And, you know, so that's how society works.
Do you want to come in on this, Rupert?
Well, I think we've talked a fair bit about the philosophical background. I just a few random observations, really. The secular liberal ultimately believes in justice. The Christian does not ultimately believe in justice. The Christian believes in forgiveness, and that is, to my mind, a reframing of morality and an enrichment and an opening up. The Judeo-Christian revolution in the history of ideas is a huge one. Ancient religion mandated human sacrifice. The weak went to the wall. There was absolutely no conception of a connection between religious practice and ethics. When the children of Israel framed a morality side by side with their monotheism and taught that care for the widow and the orphan was integral to religious practice, that really mark them out. And I see Christianity as a continuation and a radicalisation of that. But we've got to be clear. I mean, the Christian repertoire, peace, forgiveness, humility, purity of heart, they're like grains of salt. I mean, they enter a society without necessarily changing it at root. It's plain as a pikestaff if you read the gospel that slavery, for example, is incompatible with Christian teaching. Am I surprised that it took Christian societies a very, very long time to get rid of slavery? No, I'm not really. Horrific though it was, it was so rooted in really every human society that's achieved a certain level of wealth. I would like to stress that I support gay marriage. I deplore homophobia in the church. I am glad that I can do this. I mean, it's fine that secular liberals have reached similar conclusions on the basis of their own reasoning. I am pleased that I'm able to count myself an ally of Jeremy by looking at what I see as the underlying message of the Bible, which is one of radical self-giving love for the other.
We're going to have to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment's time. We're talking about whether atheists have got the wrong God. We'll be concluding our conversation between my guests Rupert Short and Jeremy Riddell in a moment.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we ask, is your smartphone killing your relationship with God? How to wait on the Lord in an age of instant communication and constant distraction. Plus, we hear stories of God on the move, literally, as we open up how a bus, tube or train ride could be your next opportunity to tell someone about Jesus. All that, plus the usual news, reviews and inspiring Christian testimonies.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Welcome back to the final part of today's programme, Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley. Don't forget that Unbelievable brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine, and I'm the senior editor of the mag. The May edition has just landed, and if you want to get a free sample copy of it, go to premierchristianity.com/freesample. And if you're a listener of Unbelievable, you might be interested in one of the testimonies we feature in the latest edition. David Wood was a nihilist atheist, and you'll read about his story, which includes trying to murder his own father and how he came to faith in prison through the intellectual arguments of one of his cellmates. So look out for that, and it's on the front page of the Premier Christianity website, premierchristianity.com. We've also been featuring some blogs as well there on behalf of the Queen's 90th birthday, which was celebrated this week. 10 brilliant quotes from the Queen about God. That's been a very popular blog this past week. As well as David Robertson writing on the wave of celebrity deaths recently in light of Prince being among the latest of them that we've seen in 2016, especially on UK shores. A lot of our beloved celebrities, entertainers, comedians, so on, passing away since the start of the year. So a bit of a cultural piece of analysis there from David Robertson, who will join me actually in a few weeks' time as a guest on a future edition of Unbelievable. Lots of exciting shows in the pipeline, actually. To speak of which, next week, no show as normal, because on the radio, at least, we're making way for our regular appeal in which we ask listeners to join with us in supporting the ministry of Premier Christian Radio. And so we're making space for that next week. So no regular Unbelievable radio show. But for those who simply can't live without a dose of Unbelievable in some format, I will be putting something out on the podcast, as I often do, something a little bit different. And this time it's going to be a program I recorded back in 2009 called A Tale of Two Mega Churches. This was a trip I took with my family at the time. There were only two children in the equation at that time, in which I visited, among other places, Joel Osteen's church in Houston, Texas, Lakewood Church, and also at the time, Rob Bell's church, which was Mars Hill Church in Michigan, and did a sort of comparison comparison and contrast between these two, well, at the time, very flourishing churches. Rob Bell, of course, has moved on since then, with that proviso that it obviously does go back to 2009. I hope you'll enjoy hearing that documentary that I produced a little while ago next week, if you're a podcast listener. Okay, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback very soon to the dialogue between Bart Ehrman and Richard Borkham, the two-part dialogue that aired over the last 2 weeks. Lots of you wanting to get in touch about that. And don't forget that straight after today's programme, you can continue listening and hear me in conversation with Baroness Caroline Cox on her life devoted to pleading the cause of the persecuted church and fighting against modern-day slavery. But for now, let's finish up today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So, coming back to you, Jeremy, do you think in the end that many atheists have got the wrong God, as far as Rupert elucidates it in this book?
I think in terms of, as Rupert elucidates it in the book, yes. But in terms of how, what many, the God that many believers believe in, no. And I think if you take, obviously we've been talking about the new atheists are referred to a lot in the book, and obviously Richard Dawkins. I know he does a lot of work in America. That's a society where atheists, there's prejudice against atheists, very marked prejudice against atheists, and where very simplistic and crude, in Rupert's terms, versions of Christianity are very strong and dominant, and where the fight for those people who can see why I believe in this is precisely against the type of conception of God that the sky God Rupert criticizes. So I think it's true that what Richard Dawkins is attacking isn't the sophisticated intellectual God of Rupert's book, but equally I'm not sure how many Christians share the sophisticated intellectual God of Rupert's book.
I mean, that's maybe a fair criticism here, Rupert, which is atheists may have the wrong God. Obviously, in your view, lots of Christians may have the wrong God as well, and you're trying to correct both in that sense. But I don't know. I mean, does Jeremy have a point here that the fact is that there are a lot of versions of Christianity which don't have the subtlety and the sophistication and the depth that you would like
yes.
to see brought?
I think we need to distinguish two things here. Richard Dawkins and several of his allies, I'm thinking of Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, they don't just claim to demolish fundamentalist religion, they claim to demolish Christianity as such. So, for example, in Dawkins's book, The God Delusion, there is a very brief, utterly trifling, utterly superficial section on the arguments of Thomas Aquinas, completely misinterpreted, in my view. That's one point, and needs to be made clearly. Jeremy has my total sympathy in regard to what he says about a lot of very shrill, dogmatic expressions of Christianity in the United States. But religion isn't going to go away. I mean, there's a very, I think, rather a complacent assumption on the part of sociologists in the past that Western Europe is the lead society. Faith is on the wane and the rest of the world can play catch-up. Well, I've got news for these secularists. Secularization has gone into reverse. Religion is not going to die. There are different kinds of shackling. There's shackling of atheists in America, which I acknowledge and I deplore. But look at many parts of the world where shallow secular assumptions involved very rigid secular straitjackets in societies ranging from India to Egypt to Turkey to Algeria. And with the so-called third wave of democratization in the 1970s, people finally started to have more of a say. And it's really sad to say this, but a lot of religious fundamentalism, particularly in the Islamic world, derives precisely from a reaction to secular straitjackets. So fundamentalism is a deeply flawed, modern response to a flawed modern policy, if you see what I mean. So that there's a kind of blindness on both sides. All I can say is that the answer to bad religion is good religion. It's not no religion at all. Three quarters of humanity profess a religious faith at the moment, and that figure is projected to rise to about 80% by the middle of the century.
What do you? I mean, that's one of the things that Rupert quotes in the book there, Jeremy. Although rates of church going have fallen steeply in Europe over recent decades, secularisation in the world as a whole has gone into reverse. I mean, that's something. Does that worry you that in fact secularisation is in reverse?
I think we have to be careful what we mean by secularisation. If your question is, do I think that, you know, religion is going to disappear, as people at one stage did, the data indicates no. Mm-hmm. You know, and but what's interesting is that if you take the UK, in this country, there is what's been called by, there's a paper last year by Charles Clark and Linda Woodhead about religious education, which referred to what's happening in the UK as the biggest change since the Reformation. And it is, and it's got two dimensions to it. One is that an enormous growth in the number of people who are non-religious, and it's about 50% now, and it will inevitably go up because of the age profile. And the other is that of the what will become the religious minority, the composition of that is changing dramatically, with the very sharp decline in identity with the Church of England, and the growth. Everyone talks about Islam growing. Islam is still, you know, 5%, and it 2050 it's going to be 10% by the projections. The biggest growth is in non-denominational Christianity, and non-denominational Christianity, particularly Pentecostalism, you know, this is miracles on a Sunday afternoon type of Christianity, speaking in tongues, this sort of you know, faith healing. This is not, you know, Rupert's very sophisticated intellectual form of Christianity. So we're going to have to come to terms in this country with a plural society which has quite big differences, not, you know, the sort of intellectual atheism plus, you know, intellectual Anglicanism. It's going to be, the differences are bigger. So to me, we have, pluralism is a fact.
Mm.
And the only way, to me, to handle that fact in a way that it leads to a peaceful society is what I would call secularism, which is not no religion, but is a society where there's a level playing field, everyone's entitled to their view, everyone's entitled to express their view, practice their faith, providing it doesn't erode the rights of other people. And that, to me, is secularism,
sure.
Which isn't saying no religion. Far from it.
There are two sides to Jeremy's kind description of my work as sophisticated. Obviously, into criticism there on the basis that this appears to be detached from the faith of the ordinary believer. All I can say in my defence, really, I'm a Catholic of a liberal stripe, and I am exploring the mainstream classical tradition. The Roman Catholic Church, for all its faults, is the largest Christian body on earth and the largest single source of education for girls among its other virtues. I've travelled to some of the poorest and neediest parts of the world. I've been into some of the largest slums in the world in Africa and Asia. I can tell you again and again, it's Catholic priests and sisters and other Christians with sleeves rolled up who are providing desperately needed relief to the poorest of the poor. Pentecostalism interests me a good deal. It is the Christian counterpart to Islamic revivalism. It is resolutely, resolutely non-violent, and because it totally eschews any kind of violence, the media doesn't really pay very much attention to it. I'm a journalist, and I know a thing or two about the corruptions of my trade. there is a deeply ingrained view that religion is A, dead in the West, and B, violent in the East. If you travel to the global South, honeycombing around the edge of the global megacity, again and again you will find these very, very democratic little Christian communities springing up. The theology may not be enormously sophisticated, but my goodness me, simply viewed in sociological terms as sources of social capital. Men are giving up the bottle, they're giving up promiscuity, women are being treated as equals, and this tradition is spreading like wildfire. Thousands of people are coming to faith every day in Africa alone, and it needs to be assessed with nuance, this trend. I'm not saying that it's altogether positive, but I do see many, many positives in it.
We need to draw things to a close. And so, any final sort of thoughts you'd like to leave us with, Jeremy, as we do that?
Yes, I don't go with the, you know, religion is the root of all evil. Obviously, there are good people doing good things who are Christians, and some of them motivated by their Christianity. And that's fine. And I would completely support that. It's also doing a lot of, has done and continues to do, bad things as well. It's a human creation, and you'd expect it to have those characteristics. So I think Rupert's book isn't aimed really at me.
Okay.
So I think it does offer internal coherence. My feeling, though, is, of course, as an atheist, I would say this, that the foundations are built on sand.
Thank you for joining us, Jeremy. And thank you for being with me as well, Rupert. Do you think... Hopefully, you said you didn't write the book to evangelise or convert anyone. Do you hope to at least make the Christian faith a little more plausible for those who are doubters, seekers, sceptics?
Yes, indeed. The category of gift is enormously important to me. I don't believe that Christianity is a human invention. I think that God didn't just make us, but that God has, in some sense, spoken to us. He has uttered a word through the life of Christ, which means that we need to jettison so many of our standard ideas about God. There's a very resonant line in a book by Terry Eagleton where he says, for Christian teaching, God's love and forgiveness are ruthlessly unforgiving powers which break violently into our protective, self-rationalising little sphere, smashing our sentimental illusions and turning our world brutally upside down. Pie in the sky, opium of the people? I don't think so.
Well, thank you very much for being with me, Rupert. Thank you, Jeremy, as well. If you want to get in touch, I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch as well in a moment's time. Perhaps you can share your thoughts on today's show. Be interested to hear from you. In the meantime, thanks for being with me on the programme today, folks. If you want links to my guests, then go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks once again to all who have been in touch about recent editions of the programme. And we have had a lot of response to the Borkum and Ehrman debate. One of the people actually responding has been James White again. He's going to be joining me in the not-too-distant future on Unbelievable. But he has his own podcast, The Dividing Line, and he took exception, you could say, to some aspects of the second debate that took place last week between Ehrman and Borkum in what he calls an issue of submitted scholarship. He feels that when you aren't, as it were, submitting yourself to the idea that Scripture is inerrant, infallible, and so on, then you are going to wander into territory where you essentially can't make a case for Christ and for Christianity. And others made similar points. And there were some skeptics who claimed it was a knockout for Bart Ehrman because they felt that he won the day in that debate on whether we can trust eyewitness testimony, the psychology of eyewitness testimony, and so on. I didn't see it like that at all, personally. And so I was surprised to see people saying that. Let me read you at least some of the various responses we've had, though. So Matt Palmer, I suppose, one of those sceptics who thinks that it was a knockout for Bart. He says that the answer is no, writing on the Facebook page of Unbelievable. Eyewitness testimony is very untrustworthy. Even asking people the day after an event, eyewitnesses always get details wrong and often falsely identify people. You need other evidence. The eyewitness testimony in the Bible was written down 40 to 100 years after the events, so are worthless. Troy James Martin, on the other hand, says, great discussion again, Justin. Bart falls into it yet again. The studies that Dr. Ehrman continually refers to in the beginning portion of the episode were so poorly applied to his thesis that it leaves me breathless. Now, if the group being surveyed about the Challenger disaster, and this was the example that Bart brought to bear about people who saw that happen on TV and they were asked the day after what they remembered about it, and then a year later what they remembered about it, and the answers varied widely. You say, now, if the group being surveyed about the Challenger disaster were the actual pad technicians and flight directors, and they gave consistently incorrect answers from year to year, you might have something there. The disciples, whose eyewitness testimony is being relied upon as the basis of the Gospels, were not simply men and women on the street who witnessed secondhand a crucifixion on TV or the radio. They were directly involved in the ministry of Christ on earth. They were his confidants. They were in mission control, as it were, and were as close to Jesus before his trial as the Secret Service guards were to President Reagan when he was shot in 1981. Bart cherry-picks all the wrong evidence to support his thesis. Surely his time as a serious scholar is nearing its end. Pretty soon we may be uttering his name as part of the same pantheon as Velikovsky. Discredited scholars whose limelight has come and gone. Raymond says, thanks again for a cracking show. I think Bart and Richard both agreed on something quite significant during the show, and that is that form criticism has had its day. But behind this combined admission is something even more noteworthy, and that is that these allegedly brilliant scholars of their day clearly got it wrong, and common sense eventually won through. I've listened to Bart and could buy into it, but in all honesty, I see no necessity. Are we really sure that it's altogether sinister? My wife and I, at a party listening to the same person, will pick up different things and recall the incident differently. Would either of us be lying thereby? I'd seriously argue the same would go for Bart and his wife. What are the Gospels? Is Bart really saying that, as authors of what essentially are biographies, no one is allowed to use source material, abbreviate some, give a fuller account of others, and introduce new material? Does the author not have the right without being accused of lying? Don't even contemporary biographies show precisely such trademarks? Thank you very much. There, you wrote much more than that, Raymond, but we'll leave it there for the moment. Phil Dudd says, I see it of no benefit to rationalise eyewitness accounts, for those accounts cannot be recounted in any bias, even innocently. It's the nature of the eyewitness's heart that makes the difference of the truth coming out. A heart that belongs to Jesus is inspired by the Holy Spirit. The heart that doesn't is easily guided by he who wants to steal, kill and destroy. This shouldn't have been about memory. It should have been about the power of God by his Holy Spirit. This one from Rich in Stafford, Virginia says, Ehrman's scepticism about the reliability of testimony is so absurd that he doesn't even realise the absurdity of the conversation you were having. If memory and testimony are so fragile as to make it doubtful in one telling, then Ehrman's own testimony about the nature of memory is doubtful. Has Ehrman only used primary sources for his book? How much time elapsed between the observation of these psychological tests and the recording of the observations? What kind of motivation did the observers have to determine whether memory is fragile? Was Ehrman himself ever a Christian, as he claims repeatedly? We can all play the hyper-skeptical game. I'd also like to point out that the Jews were not primarily an oral culture. When it came to the Word of God, they were a written culture. Theologically, the number of times it is noted that prophecy and scripture are written down in order that words would not be lost is remarkably frequent in scriptures. Paul's own directions to Timothy to bring writing instruments and Peter's notes about Paul's writings demonstrate the continued importance of a written text. Ehrman always treats the early Christian church in the abstract and fails to note the importance not of writing in general, but specifically scripture. And you say you'd recommend Michael Kruger for the show on this basis. Thank you very much, Rich. Ed says, I'm a big and new fan of the show. I feel compelled to fling myself to Borkum's defence, his Anglicanism aside, because I've already noticed, based on past shows, that Justin seems to be a tad too easy on Bart Ehrman, who dominates his debates and does so mainly, sadly, by interrupting and then simply repeating himself at higher and higher decibel levels. Bart should and could be reined in a bit, as intimidating such a prospect may be. Ehrman's good, but he's not as good as he seems to think he is, in my humble opinion. opinion. Otherwise, great stuff even for this card-carrying Presbyterian of the John Owen variety. Rich in the US says, while Bart is a convincing speaker and excellent debater, you have to stop and think before you buy into what he's selling. Galatians is a book that Ehrman agrees was written by Paul. In that book, he states in chapter 2 that it was 14 years after his first visit to Jerusalem, which would have been around 49 AD. On the show, Bart mentioned that the story of Jesus had sprung up from various cities around the Roman Empire. Paul travelled to those cities. What was the purpose of going back to Jerusalem? To make sure that I was not running or had not run in vain, and that those influential leaders added nothing to my message. In other words, Paul stated that he went back to Jerusalem to check that he had the gospel right. He met with James, Peter and John, and they added nothing to his gospel. Think for a moment about all the works of Bart Ehrman. The Jesus he portrays will be an uneducated carpenter from some podunk town on the outskirts of Galilee, preaching a message that he is ultimately crucified for. Without any miracles, without an empty tomb, why would an educated Pharisee like Paul, who was educated by the top minds in Judaism of his time and was zealous in stamping out Christianity, convert to follow this man? Unless, by Paul's own words, he appeared to me also. This from Mark says, once again, sincere thanks for the enduring contribution in the realm of apologetics. I was a little frustrated at these twin broadcasts. I believe Bart Ehrman is playing something of a shell game with a straw man argument. The whole point is that Jewish culture was far more scribal than oral, as we witness in the detailed precision of Old Testament historical accounts. Even if illiterate, the Jews would glean from the word being read to them. They were not subject at all to some tribal gathering where the elderly sage would relate vague memories in the firelight, which then had to be passed on with random variations. That's totally false. Okay. And Joel in Moundville, Alabama says, two great shows, thanks to everyone involved. On the plausibility of the disciples correctly remembering the Sermon on the Mount, I don't think anyone really hit on the fact that these teachings also would have been heard hundreds of times by the apostles, likely in very similar ways. Jesus was an itinerant preacher. He was delivering the same sermon over and over again. An analogy I believe I heard in a Tom Wright lecture. If you found someone who travelled regularly with Billy Graham 50 years ago, and you asked them about a particularly memorable crusade event, they could probably sketch out a pretty accurate description of what he preached, simply because it was what he always preached. And this one from Tony in California says, let me begin by saying I haven't read Bart's new book or much psychological research, but I was dumbfounded that the entire emphasis was placed on the memories of individuals rather than the collected memories of a tight-knit group of friends who experienced emotional, impactful and life-changing events together and who would certainly relive those things over and over together. I suppose there is research on that situation too, no? I know from experience that when I retell stories in the presence of friends, I often count on them to help put together the memories accurately. And you tell a story where just that thing happened. Tony feels that perhaps we need to look more at the idea of collective memory, and that these weren't individuals who were witnessing these things and then maybe getting the story wrong later. They were a group who were able to correct each other and bring it together. Interesting stuff. Loads of other responses that we've had and many, many comments under both shows, if you want to go and look at those as well, from a variety of skeptics and Christians. So thanks for being involved and for the enthusiasm which many people have greeted those two programmes, and of course the criticisms as well that some people have made of it. But I think you'll agree that both were worth listening to and certainly provoked a lot of reaction. I'm sure we'll get Richard and Bart on again at some point down the line. In the meantime, thanks for listening to today's programme. Don't forget to book in for Unbelievable, the conference 2016, and I'm going to be back again in a moment's time with today's profile. For now, let me tell you what's coming up next week. You're unbelievable. Well, in fact, there'll be no radio show of Unbelievable at this time next week. We're making space for our Extend the Hope financial appeal, so if you're able to contribute towards that, you'd be most welcome to do so. We'll make sure there's something on the podcast though for those who want to download it, listen at the website and so on, and that'll be a program I actually produced several years ago, A Tale of Two Mega Churches, my trip with my whole family to America when we went to see Joel Osteen and Rob Bell in their respective mega churches. And it was a documentary that was fortunate enough to win a prize at the Christian Broadcasting Council the following year. But if you want to hear it, then do check out the podcast next week at the same time. Until then, have a great week.
Get everything for your next project at Menards and save big money. We carry everything to help you breathe easier. Allergen air filters help prevent seasonal allergy symptoms and improve your indoor air quality. by capturing microparticles while allowing maximum airflow. Save big on allergen air filters when you shop at Menards. View the weekly flyer and all of our great deals happening this week on Menards.com. Save big.